You are listening to Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, the podcast. This is Friday, September 9th, 2022, episode number 3 from series 2. JJ Sefton back here in beautiful Wisconsin with CBD in New Jersey. CBD, how you doing?
I'm doing great. We've had such a lovely week. Obviously, everybody is aware that Queen Elizabeth II, the longest serving, does one serve as queen?
The longest reigning
monarch in British history, died yesterday at the age of 96. I was fascinated by the response from the left. Actually, that's a lie. I was not surprised at all, but I was disgusted by it. And we're not going to address that. What I would like to mention is that for 70 years, she was the stiff upper lip of Great Britain, the formerly Great Britain. And her quiet and strong and elegant demeanor, I think, has gone a long way to preventing the complete collapse of what was the greatest nation on earth until the Revolutionary War. And even then, Britain was a grand, grand country. And it is expected, but it is sad in a way. And I am not a fan of monarchies. I think that using genetics to choose one's rulers is awful, even more awful than the way we do it. At any rate, she comported herself well for her entire reign, and it is a testament to her parents more than anything else, and also to her love of Great Britain, and she will be missed.
My observation of it, and I echo your sentiments about monarchy, but what one feels about monarchy and what feels about this particular monarchy in general, but for the last seven decades, whether we realized it or not, her being there was just a sign or an indication of some sense of stability with all the crazy foibles going on in England post-World War II and obviously here in America and in the West. But my reaction is to her passing was quite much more profound than I think I expected, because, first of all, she is a representative of the greatest generation that saved the world from the evils of fascist tyranny. With World War II, but also her passing is very symbolic in a way of what is happening to our world and what we fought for, what that generation fought for and liberated us for, and hopefully trying to advance the ideals of freedom and liberty and progress in the real sense of the world, in the real sense of the word, not progressivism. So her passing is so symbolic, and so it really hits you on a gut level to what is happening in the world today between the forces of darkness represented by Davos and globalism and the Great Reset, the communists in China, the crazy mullahs in Iran, and so on and so forth, and most pointedly, the forces of evil that sprung up right here in America and also in England. So it really is, as I said, the sun never sets on the British Empire. Well, it definitely has finally set on the British Empire, and hopefully the lights going out there and all over the world, hopefully they will be lit in our lifetime. It's the situation is very much in doubt. But that said, I admired her, as you said, CBD, for her poise, her dignity, and her grace. And in that regard, she will be missed. So the Queen is dead, and you know, and there it
long
is.
Long live Mohammed the First.
Mohammed.
I mean, who knows what that, you know, knuckle-dragging, booger-eating moron that they now have as king is going to call himself. But I wouldn't be surprised if it were Mohammed the First.
Well, I've always, considering what they did to themselves with mass immigration from, you know, Rudyard Kipling's, you know, the white man's burden because of their empire. They allowed it in and they allowed it to subsume them. And it will not be long before Westminster Abbey goes the fate of Hagia Sophia and becomes, instead of a cathedral, it turns into a grand mosque. But, you know, the situation in that regard is very much in doubt. And speaking of mullahs and Islam and the caliphate, the situation in Iran vis-a-vis us giving them and allowing them to get the atomic bomb is front and center.
You know, it's fascinating that little Albania, a country that is unknown by most people, has stood up to Iran. Apparently, Iran played some cyber attack games with Albanian servers. I don't really know the story. And Albania severed diplomatic ties. And if little Albania can stand up to Iran and America can't, that says a lot, because we are not standing up to Iran. We are caving to every single one of their demands and trying to revive this moribund nuclear deal that President Trump very, very wisely dumped. There is no new news other than the fact that Iran is probably within months of being able, but within months of having enough enriched uranium to build the bomb. Going from 60 or 65% to the 90 plus percent that they need is a trivial exercise. It's no longer engineering. It's simply putting this sample into that centrifuge, running it for 24 hours, and there you have your sample, your nuclear weapon. The problem is that it's unclear whether the Biden junta wants them to have a nuclear weapon. My suspicion is they don't care. They would rather have a nuclear-armed Iran than a war in the Mideast. Unfortunately, once we get a nuclear-armed Iran, we will have a war in the Middle East.
This is the combination of ideology and incompetence. They think, and this was exemplified by the late Madeleine Albright, or as I think Mark Levin calls her, not so bright. When the Soviet Union collapsed and America was the lone superpower after the fall of the Soviet Union and the fall of the Berlin Wall, it was a catastrophe, not just in the eyes of Putin, but also in the eyes of the idiot at the State Department in Foggy Bottom. They think America as a sole superpower is a destabilizing element in the world, and it which is insane on its face. The same
okay,
thing.
I'm going to stop you there. It's not insane. With the current crop of morons running our foreign policy, it is not insane that America as a lone superpower is a destabilizing influence. Because they acted in such an irrational way for so long. And trust me, I blame, what's his name, Bush Sr., then I blame Clinton, then I blame Bush Jr. They did not do a very good job. Were they handed fantastic tools and an incredible opportunity? Absolutely. Did they screw it up? Absolutely. Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's okay. No, I believe me, I agree with you, but it's just, you know, it's not just, you know, Albright and the Clintons and the Democrats. You're right. It's the Bushies. It's the ingrained mentality at Foggy Bottom, which and essentially the bureaucracy in D.C., which, as we know, is part of this globalist madness to make America subservient to some global order run by the UN or Davos or probably the Chinese, really, when you really come down to nuts and bolts of it. But it's this mentality that American exceptionalism and American greatness as the lone superpower and, if you will, the moral leader, if you will, of the world, for you know, our foibles and, you know, mistakes here and there notwithstanding, they couldn't stand that. They can't abide by that. So to them, Iran getting the bomb is not a problem because they just don't see the madness of the mullahs and the whole lust for Armageddon to bring about the 13th Imam and this thing or the 12th Imam or whatever it is. So they, for them to have the state of Israel stand up to Iran or for the state of Israel to be independent and for Iran to not have a bomb and to be neutralized in their eyes is absolute madness when it's not madness. That's sanity ruling. So yes, it's the combination of incompetence and ideology that wants Iran to get an atomic bomb. I don't think they want them, or they think that they won't get a bomb, but it's, again, it's the schizophrenia of they don't want them to have the bomb, but at the same token, Israel having a nuclear weapon to defend itself or the means to defend itself from Iran, and Iran not promising not to have a nuclear bomb and we'll take care of them. Just sticking your head in the sand and praying that nothing as bad is going to happen is just the height of folly. And if Iran does break out, I guarantee you that whoever is the president in Israel, more or less, I think, at least now, we've seen there is a change in attitude of what's going on in Israel, and you're the expert on that more than I am. They will not allow that to happen. And moreover, the Saudis will not allow it to happen. The Gulf, the Emiratis, the Gulf Cooperation Council is not going to allow that to happen. And there will be war, if you want to call it that, or a military conflict or some sort of an attack that they hope will prevent Iran from either utilizing that weapon or weaponizing it into a missile and firing it or try to bring about regime change if they can do it. They're just not going to allow that to happen, no matter who is in the White House, Biden, God forbid, Kamala Harris or some other knucklehead of the left. And hopefully if it's Trump or DeSantis coming back in the next, it may be a moot point. Iran might get that bomb well before the next 2 years. But the Israelis and the Saudis are not going to allow that to happen. And there will be some sort of military happening in the Middle East should that eventuality come to pass.
I agree. What's fascinating, though, is that, you know, the European capitals are not much farther from the Iranian nuclear sites and the Iranian missile launch sites than Israel and the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, the Arabian Peninsula. And yet they are conspicuously absent in this, in any expression of concern about an Iranian nuclear weapons program. They have been so thoroughly co-opted by this, the insanity that you just described perfectly. That, you know, what, I don't even know what they're thinking. It's complete lack of thought. Oh, fiddle-dee-dee, I'll think about it tomorrow, for tomorrow is another day. Well, tomorrow might be a nuclear bomb, a nuclear missile being launched at Paris or London. And at that point, I wonder if the world will pay more attention. I certainly hope so.
Well, you know, this, it's, again, Europe is another story. Europe, it's, there are a couple of things going on. You have the crazy anti-Semitism of Islam, which goes back, you know, whatever, 1,500 years. And you have almost the equal amount of time of the anti-Semitism of the European variety, which goes back further than that, before Islam and the formation of Europe as nation states from the time of Christ going forward. So it's this ingrained, always ever present, just below the surface, always then boiling over the surface every few decades or every however long you want to call it. It's always there. As my mother of blessed memory would say, it's in their blood. And no matter what happens, and now it's even worse because you have massive Muslim migration into Europe, as well as the latent anti-Semitism that's driven by Marxist-Leninism that comes to the fore. So all of these things, it's a toxic mix. And this is why Europe doesn't necessarily care that Iran gets a bomb. And I'll even go further than say they want them to get a bomb because they see Iran as a counterbalance to the illegitimate and evil Jewish state of Israel, which should not be there and should, of course, be the state of Palestine from the river to the sea. So for Iran to get a nuclear weapon, for them, that would be a wonderful thing. That would fill them with girlish glee and delight for Iran to get a nuclear weapon. Now, if they launch it on Paris or London, who knows if it's, of course, if London gets lit up with a nuke and turns into a mushroom cloud, the first people they're going to blame, of course, are the Jews. I mean, that's
just, absolutely.
It's going to happen. But ironically, Iran will probably launch on Tel Aviv, or who knows if they launch on Jerusalem, but they'll launch one on Tel Aviv because they don't care. That's the whole thing, is people don't seem to realize that pan-Islamism is not a nationalist movement. It is a global totalitarian movement that seeks to subjugate the entire world under one Islamic roof, Greater East Asian Co-Prosperity Sphere, but you know, going back 1,500 years. So if the Palestinians, quote-unquote, get the chop, if they get lit up in Tel Aviv the same, or the West Bank, the same as the Jews, doesn't matter to them. It serves their purpose. You know, they could care less. The Palestinians, to them, are just political pawns, or pawns in a game that they're playing on another level to establish this global caliphate. But if they die, they don't care, as long as they get to do whatever they do to the Jews and wipe them out and so on and so forth. So it's kind of ironic.
We have proof of that with their own people. I mean, they sent, what, a million plus men to die against in an Iraqi war that was a stalemate for years. They didn't care.
Yeah, they could care less. For them, I forgot, was it Iran? It was Iraq that attacked Iran first, if I remember correctly. It was Saddam Hussein that, or am I remembering that wrong?
I don't know, and I don't care.
I believe it was Saddam.
All I did was cheer for casualties.
Actually, absolutely. For 10 years, it was just past the popcorn. It was a wonderful thing. Although, of course, in that time, you still had the crazy, you know, Black September group hijacking airplanes. You had, Leon Klinghoffer being shoved off of a boat, and they're writing musicals about it that make the hijackers the hero, and Leon Klinghoffer just a MacGuffin, you know, that got in the way.
Yeah.
I wonder if
the drive for an Iran nuclear deal among the Biden junta, in the Biden White House, is some masturbatory fantasy that they are going to be the saviors of the Middle East and that they are going to create this grand deal that will spread peace in the region. It's possible that they're stupid enough to believe that. President Trump looked at that region, saw that the Palestinian problem was impossible to solve, chose a side, and went from there. And if you want to talk about perfection in geopolitical maneuvering, there it is.
He chose the right side. Is that?
Yeah.
He chose the Israelis.
It doesn't matter. He chose a side.
Right. Well, the thing
Instead
is,
trying to be this grand moderator, the this uh, you know, the, I don't know, deus ex machina, I guess, is what the typical American president wants to be. And it simply would not work. It will never work. I think that the only solution, certainly of the Palestinian problem for Israel, is to beat them. Right. In this, I agree with Daniel Pipes. I usually don't agree with him, but he thinks that the solution is to beat the Palestinians in all ways. And he also believes that there is a moderate Islam in the world that can be a potent counterweight to radical Islam. And I think he's massively, massively wrong as anybody can be. In fact, there is moderate Islam, and they're the ones who don't shoot and blow up people. That's it. They support it. They just don't do it.
We had this discussion, I think, with, and we should bring him back because he's genius, Robert Spencer on this, mm-hmm. you know, one of the experts on this. And yes, there is no, I mean, he agrees with you insofar as, yes, the moderation of Islam is like, it's, you know, it's the people who, the knuckleheads who take it to the extreme, but not even the extreme, because this is their central tenet, is to kill infidels and to subjugate the world. So in that regard, when they fly airplanes into the World Trade Center or cut Daniel Pearl's head off, you know, they are practicing Islam as it is written in the Quran. And to them, there is no reformation of that, because to them, the Quran is the word of Muhammad. Muhammad is the messenger from God. That's God's word. It's perfect. It can't be changed. So there is no Vatican II, if you will, in the Islamic world. Now, that said, there might be a softening, or who knows if to a certain extent, with people like Mohammed bin Sultan and others who have at least have some sort of a rapprochement with Israel. Maybe it's just for their own self-preservation to beat the enemy of my enemy, which is Iran. But there is a change. There is some change going on, and there has to be in the hearts and minds of people. But because to continue to go on like this for 1,500 years and just to be crazy, you know, in like, you know, kill the infidel, and while you're suffering, you know, I think Donald Trump opened up a lot of eyes, not just here in the United States and in the West, but also in the Middle East. And this was what the Abraham Accords was so genius, because he broke this logjam of, you know, the peace process as the end in itself, because there was no peace process. The only peace process was, what is Israel going to give up this time in exchange for getting, you know, another round of rockets and bombs fired at them? And it's lather, rinse, repeat, year after year after year. And every time that happens, it's always the Israelis that are the intractable ones. If only they just, you know, if only they just agreed to stick their heads in the oven and die like they should have done, you know, with Hitler, then everything would be sweetness and light in the Middle East. But of course, it's the self-licking ice cream cone that keeps going and going and going. Because when you do solve a problem, guess what you no longer need? You no longer need the bureaucracy. And you no longer need, you know, the peace process, peaceniks, constantly doing shuttle diplomacy, which accomplishes nothing but lines their bank accounts and makes them feel good. So that was the genius of the Abraham Accords and of Donald Trump recognizing that the problem isn't finding some solution that the Palestinians, quote unquote, will be happy with, but saying, screw it, the Palestinians are intractable, they don't want peace, they want to wipe Israel off the map, it's time we recognize that and just move on from there and try to address the problems inherent in the other countries and stop making the Palestinians the political pawn that everybody uses in order to beat up the West, beat up Israel, and keep this thing going forever and ever. Brilliant move.
And the carrot was marvelously simple, and that is commerce. It is so simple to get people's attention. Hey, your country can make lots of money. You can make lots of money. You can get lots of tourism. You can get lots of high tech. You can get all sorts of the cool stuff that Israel has in abundance, if only you accepted, you know, the most minimal of international, I can't even think of the word, guarantees that you're not going to start a war. That's pretty much it. And from there, everything flowed. And it was a wonderful thing. It was a simple thing. I doubt very much it was a difficult negotiation. Because as you say, starting from the position of we've moved on from the Palestinian issue, let's figure something out, is easy.
Right. You have to do that. You have to do that from a position of strength. And Trump had that. Because with any other president, I think, who would have done that, it would have been, you know, screw you. No, we're not. We have the oil weapon. That was the other part of it, was the oil weapon that was always used against us. Well, guess what? In the Trump years, we had the oil weapon. We were fracking like crazy. We were drilling for gas. We were, you know, we were the first time.
$40 a barrel oil.
$40 a barrel. It was like, yeah, gasoline was down to like, what, $2? Less than $2 a gallon.
$2 for a little while.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that a lot of heads turned with that. Plus, during that time, I believe Israel and I believe it was Cyprus and Greece, discovered that massive gas field off of their coast in the Mediterranean. And it was no longer this whole using oil as a weapon to beat up the West and get what they want was not going to cut it anymore. So now it was, okay, we better sit down and play ball, and you know, whatever our hatred of Israel, hatred of the Jews may be, let's kind of at least put that on the side and, you know, get right with the man, because, you know, oil is not going to be, you know, it's not going to be a weapon anymore. And it sidelined Putin. It sidelined everybody. The United States was, it was incredible. It was the greatest economic and foreign policy and domestic policy boom in history, except the left could not accept it. And not only the left, the deep state, who screwed this country up since the end of World War II by pursuing this mad dream of making America some sort of vassal state to a global government. And so Trump had to be removed. But circling back now to oil and to the Middle East, yeah, all these countries got on board. And beyond that, if you just look at, forget about Saudi Arabia, because they have their problems. But if you look at the Emirates, you look at Dubai, you look at Bahrain, Abu Dhabi, these places, you know, they didn't have so much oil, or their oil was diminishing, the ability for them to extract it, and they became a sort of a commercial bridge, if you will, between West and East. And say what you will about, you know, with Prince Sheikh Mohammed, you know, bin Maktoum, say what you will about that country and its problems, it's a jewel. It really is a commercial and economic success. And I think beyond Israel, you looked at them and a lot of countries said, hey, we should be able to do that. So you had Morocco, you had a bunch of other Islamic countries. I think it was Somalia even. Was Somalia joined the equation? One of these weird
countries. I don't think so.
Not Somalia, but there was Sudan. But there were these countries that joined in with the Gulf and with the Emiratis, and the Saudis were on the verge of doing it until, you know, obviously the election was. Well, they have a ticklish situation since they are the capital of Islam, if you will, and that might be a bridge too far for them to do it. But they've certainly tantalizingly come very close to doing it, and their press and their announcements are no longer really all this Wahhabist, anti-Jewish, it's probably there, I'm sure, in the background. But a lot of their press statements are not pro-Palestinian, at the very least, sometimes very highly critical of them. And so, you know, what a triumph this was. I can't even, and I look at it now and I'm going, God damn it, you know, Iran is on the verge of getting a bomb when they're literally they were this close to collapsing, and they still may be on the verge of collapsing internally because their economy is in ruins. The Iranian people are not happy with them at all. So, but we're giving them billions and billions in aid to float the mullahs and to float the Revolutionary Guard and all this kind of stuff. And oil here is you know, we're decapitating. We're going back to the Dark Ages with you know, literally and freezing to death like Europe will. And Putin is, you know, he controls the tap. Absolute insanity.
Well, you mentioned the Israeli gas fields, and it's delicious irony that Israel will be selling natural gas to Europe to warm them this winter. It's just delightful. Although I have to say, a part of me, a very large part of me, would love to see a dark Europe this winter.
Oh, hell yeah.
Just to teach them a lesson.
Oh, hell yeah.
I would laugh. It would make me very, very happy.
Oh, absolutely. Israel, I mean, you know, and again, I go back to my mother, who, as many of you know, survived Mr. Schicklgruber at, you know, death camp and a death march and the labor brigades. You know, she used to say, man, and she actually was upset that the wall came down, because she wanted Russia. She wanted Russia to roll all the way to the English Channel for what the Europeans, with the exception of Denmark and the exception, I think, of even Bulgaria, did to its Jews, willingly handing them over and killing them. So she could have cared less if the Iron Curtain fell on the English Channel. But that's another story. But you are right. For their crazy anti-Americanism, anti-Israel attitudes, the socialism, the madness of the Green Movement, it is ironic now that Germany is actually looking to fire up more coal plants and start more nuclear plants because they know that this whole thing of windmills and unicorn farts and turbines and whatever magic potions they have is just not going to work. And as we've said many times, it's not even just about heating and gasoline and transportation. Oil is life. Oil gives life. Carbon is the essential element of life. Carbon dioxide is nature's miracle life giver. Without any of these things, we would be in the Dark Ages. We would be worse than the Dark Ages. We'd be, you know, back in the trees picking nits and fighting over the termite mound and who gets to eat what. So, great.
With that, let's take a short break, and we'll be back in a few with a little bit more of a philosophical topic.
Back in a play. We are back. Cutshave Newsletter Speaks, the podcast, Series 2, Episode 3, J.J. Sefton, CBD, Friday, September 9th. And you know what's really nice is it's very comforting that we are now all enemies of the state, thanks to our wonderful president, SpongeBrain Shitspants, who mouthed the words, maybe it was theoretically or allegedly John Meacham, who wrote that. Really, the most horrendous speech ever given by any United States president or in history, I think.
Well, I mean, the fact that they dig up the set from Triumph of the Will and have him give a speech from there is pretty impressive. I have to give them credit for that. No, every little bit of that, the overtly militaristic, what were they, Marine guards flanking him and the blood red lighting and the...
The blood red lighting on Independence Hall. I mean,
yeah,
oh my God.
It was just unbelievable. But what fascinates me is the anger and the disgust that he expressed. He's saying the soft part out loud. It is very, very clear that we are undergoing a sea change in the United States. There is a schism, and it's getting worse. The idea that Americans, loyal Americans, people who love this country, are described as enemies of the state by the President of the United States is beyond the pale. If I had any hope that we could solve this without bloodshed, I think it disappeared last week. You know, his combination of anger and hatred and catastrophic stupidity and rigidity is a very, very dangerous thing because he is completely comfortable with destroying the Democrat Party, with destroying America, with destroying all that 2.5 centuries of incredible American exceptionalism have created on the altar of his psychotic, odd, and let's face it, his politics are odd.
His politics are driven by one thing only, it's greed. He also hates people who point out his complete ineptitude and his complete, a plagiarism. The man has never had an original thought in when he had a mind to have an original thought without the dementia. He is a ne'er-do-well, he is a failure, he is a typical crook.
Back. We had a bit of a technical difficulty. However, I was immensely pleased with Sefton's rant about how absolutely disgusting and small and vile our current ersatz president is. He used a wonderful term, a ne'er-do-well, which is perfect. Anyway, I'm going to let him finish his rant.
Yeah, basically, you know, it's funny. I was saying that how you know, we all talk about Biden having dementia, which he clearly does have dementia. He's an absolute, at this point, he's literally three steps away from being, you know, Karen Ann Quinlan, the bionic legs. But the problem is, what's amazing is that he becomes so absolutely crystal clear and lucid when he is railing against his enemies. And it's amazing how, even though the speech is, as I mentioned before, the glitch, that it looks like it was written by the hack John Meacham, or Meacham, however you pronounce his name. But the sentiment comes right. It's from the heart. Biden saw those
Goebbels, but
Goebbels, jawohl. In the original German, it's always wonderful to comprehend. But in any case, it's amazing how he is very lucid when he is attacking his enemies, political and personal. And what's amazing is, as I said, Biden is a ne'er-do-well. He has accomplished, the only thing he has accomplished in 50 years in public life is the fact that he has been able to rise to one level of criminality after the next, until in Congress and then as vice president, then finally as the installed phony president. He's literally selling America out to our enemies for money. He doesn't care if Iran gets an atomic bomb. He's just getting paid. He's getting a shit ton of money from the Chinese, from everywhere you look. Is, you know, the big guy gets his 10%, but now the 10% is, you know, it's massive. It's unbelievable what he's doing. But at the same token, he has now raised the level of discourse with this speech by using the very deliberate phrase, the clear and present danger, which I believe was used by Wilson way back when to silence critics of World War One, when of our involvement in World War One and beforehand, as a pretext to possibly arrest people, you know, on sedition charges or phony or otherwise. And this is exactly what they're doing. They're literally, I think Daniel Greenfield had a great post on Friday in Front Page Mag. The next step is literally to criminalize the Republican Party, meaning people who vote Republican, and thereby, you know, seal the deal. If they're going to say that we are a clear and present danger, which is essentially equating us with traitors and insurrectionists and people wanting to overthrow the country like they have, basically overthrow the overthrow, then there are no limits. There is no stopping them. There is nothing that they cannot do. In fact, Steve Bannon, who voluntarily surrendered himself, I believe, to the district attorney's office, what did Letitia James do? She didn't care. She literally handcuffed him and frog marched him in front of the cameras. And at the same time, Bannon is now reporting that at least 35 to 50 Trump acolytes or supporters or people that were either in his administration or supporting him have also been arrested by the FBI. You know, we are completely, I mean, we're talking about, you know, yesterday, the great Dave in Florida was going on, and you guys were talking about, you know, the chances of what's going on with the elections. But again, what do elections really mean when this kind of thing is going to be happening? It's really frightening.
Well, in fact, it is happening already, and even worse than what you just described. Hochul, the fascist fake governor of New York, is talking about increasing the surveillance of people with guns and who are applying for gun permits in the state of New York. And she's talking about looking at their social media for radical ideologies. Well, you know, it used to be in this country that communism was a radical ideology. No more. Apparently, anything right of Stalin is a radical ideology, and she's going to set the New York State Troopers on them. You know, they're the jackbooted thugs of New York are second to none in this country. Well, I don't know. New Jersey State Troopers.
The FBI is up there. Lest we forget our wonderful ham and eggers at the FBI, Andrew McCarthy. Unbelievable.
I'm going to read a quotation from her. It's terrifying. We also talked about, I mentioned social media a number of times. I've called upon and working closely with our attorney general to identify what's going on in social media. Those questions are now part of our background check, such as like in the old days, you'd talk to someone's neighbor. Now you can talk to their neighbors online and find out whether or not this person has been spouting philosophies that indicate they have been radicalized. And that's how we protect our citizens as well. Ignoring the fact that she can't speak the goddamned language, that's a terrifying phrase. Philosophies that indicate they have been radicalized. And who decides what is radical and what is not? Well, the socialists in the New York legislature, possibly, but certainly Hochul, who is absolutely a hack politician. She's done nothing in her life except suck on the government teat, kick no bid contracts to people, which, by the way, she just did a couple of days ago. and vilify her enemies. And her enemies are, unfortunately, freedom-loving Americans.
You know, CBD, this is in the wake of, and we should put a little bit of context, this is in the wake of the, I forget the name of the case, but the Supreme Court tossed out the horrendous New York gun laws about concealed carry and basically legalized what was really, was always legal if you really follow the Constitution, the Second Amendment, of concealed carry. And she said, oh, the Supreme Court's going to do this. Well, how about this? So she and her minions in the New York legislature, the Democrats, threw up all these unconstitutional roadblocks that literally is a thumb in the eye and flipping the bird off to the Supreme Court, which just said the law that you tried to impose is unconstitutional. Stop and cease and desist. And she said, oh yeah, go fuck yourself, if I could use that phrase in a sentence. So again, just to circle back now to the broader picture of demonizing and hunting down your political enemies and all sorts of political dissent. What does any of this mean? I mean, if the Supreme Court, if you were going to, you know, forgetting their crazy decisions in the past, but look, if supposedly they're a co-equal branch of government that is the regulator and the arbiter of what is and what is not constitutional and what a government can and cannot do, whether at the federal, state, or local level, then if someone is going to give the finger to them, then really all bets are off. Well, what is the purpose of the Democrats packing the court if you have people like Hochul and even Biden and whomever, you know, giving the finger to the court when they don't like a decision that is handed down by them? I mean, I've also heard everything from packing the court to literally just abolishing the court in the wake of the Roe versus Wade, Dobbs decision. But this just means that it's another indicator that our society is completely, we're divided into two irreconcilable camps. And for all intents and purposes, there is a de facto civil war. You cannot have a civil society unless people respect the boundaries and the limits of a common law and a common heritage that are placed in front of them and a common history. If one side is going to reject that outright, then you do not have a society. You do not have a nation of laws. You have a nation of men or thugs or whoever is in charge, and all bets are off. So this is just what Hochul is doing, is just indicative of the fact of just disregard for the law when it doesn't suit their purposes.
We've talked with guests in the past about how the possible national divorce or even possibly a national civil war occurs and how does it end up. And it's interesting that, you know, New York State and you know, the Northeast and California and Illinois are pushing so very, very hard to demonize anybody who believes in limited government, the power of the Constitution to protect our rights, and those rights themselves. The New York State Legislature essentially passed a law saying that, sure, we will abide by the Supreme Court decision in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin, except that you can no longer carry a gun in so many places in New York that it is essentially no change. Nobody can carry a gun anywhere in the state of New York. I think public highways are legal, public sidewalks, but you can't carry them in Times Square, for instance, because, you know, there's no crime in Times Square. So I guess that's OK. But the idea, as you point out, that there is no longer the rule of law. And that's terrifying to me. As you mentioned, Bannon disclosed that up to 50 MAGA supporters of President Trump were served warrants and their homes and computers were searched. What are they looking for? Apparently the search criteria were so unbelievably broad, you know, all electronic communication from 6 months before the election to 6 months after the election, that kind of nonsense. It's obviously unconstitutional. It's obviously an affront to the rights of American citizens. And yet they feel perfectly comfortable, even after the incredible backlash they caught for the warrant, the illegal warrant served on President Trump in Florida, and yet they double down. And that's what puzzles me. They are either so unbelievably out of touch with the American people, or they simply don't care. And I think it might be both.
As Frank Zappa intoned, CBD, you have butted up against what is known as the crux of the biscuit here. The reason the Democrats are doing this is because they know or they believe that there is nothing that the American people are so, unlike the way they portray us as, you know, bloodthirsty, knuckle-dragging rapists and Klansmen, which they're the Klansmen. But in any event, they know that we're not going to do anything. they can just push and push and push and push. There is no, you know, there's no organized, shall we say, for lack of a better word, militia or front or movement. There is no, shall we say, a JDL that's on the national level that represents at this point a political / paramilitary force that is going to really tell the government not one step further, or you are going to get a bloody nose for doing this. And so what I'm asking is, at what point do the American people either organize themselves into resistance, into whether it's passive, hopefully passive resistance at all of this, call it a national strike, call it whatever you will, or God forbid, we devolve into Sarajevo circa 1992. And the character of the American citizen is a nonviolent, God-fearing, Jew, Christian, who goes to church and pays his taxes, tries to do the right thing, and really just wants to be left alone and does not want to interfere with what his neighbor or her neighbor is doing. And that has always been the essence of the American character. But we don't have that anymore. We have this an overthrown government. We have a leftist, at least a third of the country, if God forbid not half of the country, that wants to either subjugate us or kill us. And now they have the official government instrumentalities of government at their disposal to do just that. So all of these things, perp walking Steve Bannon, raiding Mar-a-Lago, phony kidnapping plots with Whitmer, the phony January 6th insurrection and riot, which really all the violence was on their end of it, and there was just an entrapment scam. So all of these things are just pushing and pushing and pushing. And then at what point, or is there a point where somebody says enough is enough? And my other fear is that no one is going to do this, and this is what the left is pushing for. They're just going to engineer some sort of pretext or another, a Ruby Ridge, and literally use that as the means to outlaw the Republican Party and declare a dictatorship.
I don't think it's going to be overt that way. I think it's going to be, if they are successful, I think it will be nibbling away at the edges of our freedoms, and as they are doing right now and have been for the last 50 years. So this is nothing clever that I'm saying. But I know that we're running a little long. However, I would like to give our listeners a glimpse of what a Democrat socialist America is going to be like. And we can see that in Jackson, Mississippi.
Hold that thought, Jackson, Mississippi, and we'll take a little bit of a break and give the listeners a chance to breathe and go for the alcohol. And we will be back with Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, the podcast, episode 3, Hanging in There. We're back. Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, the podcast, episode 3, season 2. JJ Sefton here with the great CBD. CBD, where we're talking about that wonderful paradise on earth known as Jackson, Mississippi. What's going on there?
Well, I was pointing out that Jackson, Mississippi is a glimpse of what a Democrat run or a Democrat socialist run America will be like. And that is a catastrophe around every corner. One of the glories of America is that things used to work very, very well. You know, we had the greatest engineering in the world. We had the greatest infrastructure in the world. We can build any, or we used to be able to build anything, maintain anything. And Jackson is a great example of what happens when you hire people for the color of their skin or what's between their legs rather than the skill at which they can perform their duties. The mayor of Jackson, Mississippi is a man named Chukwe Antar Lumumba. That's a mouthful. And I wonder if he really knows who Lumumba was.
Patrice, yes.
Yeah.
I believe the mayor of Nairobi is John Smith, but that's neither here nor there.
Anyway, so he was at a press conference last week, and he claimed that the ongoing mess in the Jackson, Mississippi water supply would cost up to $1 billion to fix. And it was an indefinite water issue. I don't know what that means, indefinite water issue. That's just blather. That's politicians speak. Anyway, usually possibly competent Army Corps of Engineers showed up. And within 24 hours, the water crisis was over, which I find fascinating. I assume that some switch had to be flipped from off to on and everything ran well the way it was designed. But this has been an ongoing problem in Jackson, Mississippi, and the charming woman named Mary D. Carter, who was the deputy director of water operations for the last 8 years, couldn't fix the problem that the Corps of Engineers fixed in less than 24 hours. That is what America is going to look like. We are going to have crappy water. We are going to have intermittent electricity. We are going to have natural gas that may or may not flow through the flow through the pipes. We are going to have garbage piling up in the streets. We're going to have bridges that fall down. We're going to have airplanes that fall from the sky. And this is as a result of the shift from an idea that excellence was the ultimate goal to the idea that a black, lesbian, tranny leftist is the perfect choice to run the water department. I'm done.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, exactly. Look, it has nothing. Again, it's not necessarily the color of the skin. It's or, you know, it's what or what's between their legs. It's what's between their ears that counts, you know, the brain matter and the competence, as you say. But look what's going on in our schools. It's beyond just picking people for all of those things as opposed to meritocracy, which is what we used to do. We have lowered standards to such a degree to allow, you know, and I don't mean just to denigrate blacks and Hispanics and others from the inner city school systems, but they've been sold a bill of goods and they've been abused. It's the greatest case of child abuse in history. The school systems have been, you know, run by leftists for however many generations now, and because of societal dissolution, thanks to the Great Society, thanks to institutional bastardy because of the welfare state and broken homes and so on and so forth, inner city children, and now believe it or not, just children in general are not receiving any kind of an education. They are receiving the craziest form of indoctrination that is imaginable. So we have lowered standards to such a degree that just it's just all about socially what my parents, who were teachers in the city system for many years, it was, you know, passing for social means, just because somebody was in the fifth grade two or three times, just get them the hell out of the school and let's and move the problem on up the chain, so to speak. And this is disaster. We are not educating children, we are indoctrinating them with the craziest notions of, you know, the diversity, inclusion, and equity, which spells D-I-E, to the point where I believe it's now at the university level and at the medical school level, where medical schools are now not looking for the most competent applicants to be. They are looking for people strictly based on skin color, on genitals, and on so on and so forth. And if that's the case,
in Jackson, Mississippi, I'm sure there's some 20-year employee who's just scratching his head and saying, my God, this woman is a moron. Why didn't she do this? Why didn't she ask us to do this? Well, we weren't allowed to do that because of, you know, the process. But the process in the United States has become so racially sensitive and so, I don't know, pressure group sensitive, perhaps. I don't know. Let's cut that out.
Look, I kind of agree with, you know, well, we can, whatever. But I mean, in a way, it is. You are. You know, and here I am. I'm, you know, if I say the so-called, and it just pains me to have to say the N-word, when I cannot use the N-word in a critical, you know, just in a clinical way, but it's people are so afraid of stepping on toes because they don't want to offend the wrong parties. That's number one. And number two, the quote unquote wrong parties, the so-called victims in this victim culture of ours, are so ingrained to think of themselves as victims. They wear their victimhood as a crown, as a badge of superiority. So if God forbid you look at somebody even cross-eyed, or you ask this Mary Carter, Mary, why don't you throw the switch over here that does the Rube Goldberg thing to clean up the water? She'd probably accuse you of racism. You'd lose your job, and that would be the end of you. So this is just—it's a catastrophe. This is absolute. We're doomed if this is the mentality that just regular people think, and you know, you walk on eggshells just for no reason whatsoever because they want you to do that. It's almost in a way, it's brainwashing on a cultural level that's been going on a national level. It's been going on now for, you know, since the 60s. Crazy.
It is insane. I mean, listen, NBC News reported the problems in Jackson, Mississippi as environmental racism, even though the Mississippi is majority black. Jackson is run by the blacks who live there. I mean, how can that be racism? It's insanity.
It is insanity. I mean, that's why I am so sick to death of hearing this whole thing of structural racism. America is a white city and always has been and always will be, and black people can never get ahead. And I say, if that is the case, how do you account for Barack Obama? Forget Barack Obama. How do you account for someone like Oprah Winfrey? Whatever you think of Oprah Winfrey, here is a black woman who, of whatever talents you think she has or does not have, she has amassed a literally, she's the I think she's one of the wealthiest women in the world. I think she's one of the wealthiest women in America. She's worth about $3.5-4 billion. Now you tell me, how does Oprah Winfrey get $3 billion? Is she playing an Aunt Jemima? Is she doing step and fetch it for the white man? Or does racism not exist? It's one or the other. Either Barack Obama is a puppet and playing a part, or it doesn't exist.
The thing is that it does not exist in any substantive way in the United States right now, and it hasn't for a very, very long time. It did in the past. I'm not going to defend America's racist tendencies, because there were racist tendencies in America, and they're gone. The fact is,
no, absolutely.
Outside of the Northeast,
yeah. Go ahead.
This country is relatively integrated. The most segregated places I've ever seen in my experience in the United States have been San Francisco, Boston, and New York. The farther south I go, the more integrated it is. I remember when I was a late teenager, early 20s, I went with a friend of mine on a business trip to Washington, D.C. And we went out to a very nice restaurant, and I looked around and realized why it was so different than the restaurants I'd been to in New York. And the answer was, there were lots of black people there and nobody cared. And this is 40 years ago. Oh, I'm tipping off my age. The thing is that we have moved, well, the vast majority of America has moved on from whatever racist tendencies it may have had. And we are a post-racial society. However, a racial society is a huge, huge and powerful thing for the Democrat Party, and they want it back. And they're fighting
to
bring it back. And you know something? They're succeeding.
Bingo. I mean, again, they're succeeding, but they're not succeeding. I think they're succeeding insofar as the most radical and crazy elements of society and the most, you know, uneducated, unreconstructed people who, as I said, this is the product of the school systems, because the school systems are in place for the last 40 years not to educate and uplift, but to keep people down and to keep them stupid and to keep them angry, because they're pumping them full of this racialist nonsense from Ibram Excrement and this Nicole Hannah Krylon here, whatever her name is, with the 1619 project to inculcate that America is structurally racist. You can never get ahead. And there ain't no making it, as one of these horrible books that I saw once proclaims. And that's just not the case. As I said, you know, how do you account for these other people? Either they're tokens and they're playing a part and you should be angry at that, or there is no systemic racism. Yes, CBD, you're right. There was Americans, unfortunately, and a lot of it, of course, the Democrats, because they're the ones who formed the Klan, there was a lot of racism in this country going back many, many years. And you're right. You hit the nail right on the head. The only reason the Democrats are empowered is because they have to sow division and to sow anger and to sow discord and discontent and to blame white society and wealthy people and capitalism as the reason that these things are happening to them. Not the policies, of course, like Jackson, Mississippi, and Flint, Michigan, and Compton, and half a hundred other hell holes on earth that burned after the riots Ferguson. But the fact is, and this is part and parcel of Marxist-Leninism, we have always been, you know, we're essentially a classless society, not classless, but yes, certain
types of
classes.
Well, many of our classes.
So that aspect of Marxism, let me finish my brainwave. That aspect of it couldn't work. So the only other way to sow division is in terms of racism and feminism. And so once you got that, it all falls into place. That's their power base.
Well, with that, I think we're going to adjourn to better pastures and a cup of coffee.
Let's get better pastures and a cup of coffee and take a little bit of break, and we'll be right back. Hang in there. Sorry, folks, we teased you that we were going to be back with some other rant, but the cup of coffee is calling, and that's it for this episode of the Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks podcast. For CBD, it's JJ Sefton. Thanks once again. We will try to make it a more frequent thing, but I'm actually heading off to Home Depot to saw my fingers off and build some shelves. See you next time. See you soon, I hope.
Thanks for listening, folks.